We are continuing our survey here in the Gospels. And this evening, what we're going to do is to pick up the time in the late fall, just following the fall festivals of 29 A.D. We'll pick it up in the late fall of 29 and follow through about 6 months up until just before the Passover of 30 A.D., So this was a time during which Jesus was pursuing his Galilean ministry. A lot of times what people don't realize is that Jesus Christ, during his ministry, spent a comparatively very short time in the area of Judea and Jerusalem. A little bit went a long way. And when he spent very much time there, the pot boiled over quickly. Galilee was a very populous area. In fact, it was the most populous part. And Christ spent time going throughout the cities and towns of Galilee. And that's where most of his mighty works and miracles were done. And he even alludes to that. Now, the section that we're getting into this evening deals with some of the parables. You know, parables serve both to clarify and to obscure. Most people think, well, you know, Christ told parables to so that everybody can understand what he meant. Well, no, that's exactly the opposite of what the Scripture says. And yet, parables do make things clear and understandable if you know the key to the parable. You know, a number of times after Christ had told the parable, the disciples came to him afterward and they said, Lord, what exactly did you mean? What was that about? And then he would explain to them the key to the parable, and everything just sort of opened up. One thing I think we have to be careful of in a parable, realize that the parable was told to illustrate a basic truth. And any sort of illustration begins to break down if you start going through trying to find special significance about every single word and everything that was mentioned. Christ emphasized the things we're supposed to get out of it, and the parable paints a word picture. You know, it uses something, and once you understand the point that he was driving at, which unless he explained it, you wouldn't, then it opens it up. And no parable, no illustration gives a complete picture. It only gives an aspect. That's why there are many parables where he said, well, the kingdom of heaven is like. And it's like this, and it's like that, and it's like something else. Because no one physical illustration totally sums up everything about the kingdom. But various things will illustrate different points. Now, Matthew, Mark, and Luke follow through the commentators generally refer to them as the Synoptic Gospels. What is recognized is that Matthew, Mark, and Luke have many parallels. The story that they contain is similar, where John focuses in on different material. John was written much later, and he didn't need to go back and retell the story that they did. Now, you find that there are differences between Matthew, Mark, and Luke. The differences had to do, of course, with the style and with the emphasis. Matthew is more concerned about subject matter than chronology. One of the reasons that we often go to Matthew's account is he tends to give the most complete description of what Christ said. You go to the Sermon on the Mount, you go to the Olivet Prophecy, you go to many of these things. Realize that over a period of 3.5 years, how many multiple hundreds of sermons did Jesus Christ give? Sermons and talks. Realize that in many of those, there was undoubtedly overlap. But it wasn't word for word. You know, he would emphasize certain things depending on the audience, depending on the circumstances, depending on a lot of things. So, on a particular subject, Jesus may have, on a particular occasion, given a discourse on this subject. But he probably touched on that subject who knows how many other times. What Matthew tends to do is to bring together what Christ said on a given subject from maybe more than one occasion. As he follows through sort of a rough chronological point, but when he gets focused down on the subject matter. Mark, on the other hand, tends to... Mark and Luke follow a little more of a chronological approach in giving the account of the life of Christ, and Mark perhaps even more so than Luke. Matthew follows chronology in a general sense, but is more oriented toward the subject matter. So what we will often do through the course of the study is that we will follow Mark through as sort of the basic story, and then we'll go to Matthew and Luke to fill in details. Now, we pick up the story here in Mark chapter 4. Mark 4, of course, started out with Christ teaching many things by parables. And as we come on down, he talks about the parable of the sower and the seed. As he comes on down in verse 21 of Mark 21, Mark 4, excuse me, not 21 chapters in Mark, are there? Mark 4:21. He said unto them, "Is a candle brought to be put under a bushel or under a bed, and not to be set on a candlestick?" Well, that's a pretty obvious question. You know, the reason you have a candle is set it up so people can see it. It's to illuminate a room. "There's nothing hidden which shall not be manifested, neither anything kept secret that it shall not come abroad. If any man have ears to hear, let him hear." You know, what he's saying here is in the context of what he has set up earlier here in Mark 4. You know, in Mark 4:9, after he had told the parable, he said unto them, "He that has ears to hear, let him hear." When he was alone, verse 10, they that were about him with the 12 asked of him the parable. And he said unto them, "Unto you is given to know the mystery of the kingdom of God, but unto them that are without, all these things are done in parables." So it was really not the time for everyone to understand. And he explained the keys, you see, and began to explain certain things. But he made the point on down in verse 21, you know, none of this is intended to be permanently hidden. At the appropriate time, you know, it's there to be understood. And he said in verse 24, "Take heed what you hear. With what measure you meet, it shall be measured to you. And unto you that hear shall more be given." With the way you measure it out. You know, take heed what you hear. You know, that's an important thing for us to realize. It's easy for us to take for granted the truth. I had opportunity to visit with two different individuals this week. One man up in the Oklahoma City area on Sunday, and then this new couple here this afternoon. And when you're talking to somebody who's new, who's been watching the telecast for a while, gotten a few booklets, you know, it impresses upon you afresh the fact that we tend to take a lot of things for granted. Oh, we've heard that, you know, we know all that. And Christ said, you know, take heed what you hear. With what measure you mete it out, it'll be measured to you again. Unto you that hear shall more be given. You know, if you take and apply what you learn, God will open your mind to understand more. But it's important for us to take seriously what we hear, not to treat it lightly and casually. So he goes on down and tells and gives other parables. He says in verse 26, "The kingdom of God is like a man casting seed into the ground. And he rises, he should sleep and rise night and day, and the seed and spring and grow up, he knows not how. The earth brings forth fruit of herself, first the blade, then the ear, after the full corn in the ear. When the fruit is brought forth immediately, he puts in the sickle, because the harvest is come." So You know, how is it that of millions of people who hear the truth, in some it takes root and it begins to grow, and in others it doesn't? You know, you go out and plant seed. How is it that that little seed can produce this plant and all these things? Well, he says, what's the comparison to the kingdom of God? Well, verse 31, he says it's like a mustard seed. It's a tiny little seed, smaller than other seeds, and yet you plant it and it grows and becomes great and puts out, you know, branches and leaves, and birds come and nest in it. So, you know, he goes on down. Let's sort of hold our place here, and let's go back to Matthew 13. Because Matthew 13 gives the parable of gives these parables. The parable of the sower and the seed is up earlier, and then he comes on down in Matthew chapter 13, and he talks about the kingdom of God, verse 44, treasure hidden in a field, merchant man seeking goodly pearls, verse 45. We went through some of that last time. And then the kingdom is like a net. So he told all these parables. Now, he mentioned the mustard seed up in verse 31, Matthew 13:31. The kingdom of heaven is like a grain of mustard seed. We read it there in Mark. And then Matthew describes another parable that he told, that whether or not he spoke it at the same time, it illustrated the same principle. So Matthew included it with this. Another parable he spoke unto them, verse 33. The kingdom of heaven is like leaven, which a woman took and hid in three measures of meal until it was all leavened. All these things Jesus spoke unto that multitude in parables. Without a parable, he didn't speak anything. Now, he was drawing the analogy of the kingdom being likened to a grain of mustard seed, likened to leaven. The common factor in both of those is something that starts out in a very tiny way and then grows to be large and great. You know, when Christ came, the knowledge and understanding of God's way was taught only to a handful of disciples. At the end of his 3.5 years of ministry, there were 120 disciples. You know, Isaiah 11 talks about a time when the earth will be covered with the knowledge of God. When the knowledge of God will, you know, God's word will go out from Jerusalem and all nations. So here's something that starts out very, very tiny. Jesus initially calls out a handful of individuals, and starting in a very tiny, insignificant way. Seeming. How much more insignificant can you get? You know, as the Romans looked at it, Judea was about as insignificant a place as they had in the empire. It was this little troublesome spot over here. That's a pretty insignificant place. And here we've got this, as they looked at it, you know, this insignificant Jew, because all Jews were pretty insignificant, and you know, here's this insignificant Jew and a handful of other insignificant Jews, and you know, what does that count for? Well, folks are going to find out in a few years, you know, when that so-called insignificant Jew returns as King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and the 12 apostles were raised up in glory and power and sit on 12 thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. You see, it's like the leavening is used here. You know, the same physical thing can illustrate different points. Leavening spreads. That ingredient or that quality of spreading. You put in just a little bit in with the flour and to make a dough, but it permeates. It spreads, and so that's a key thing. Now here. As in Matthew 13, continuing on, let's notice a little bit of the this matter of the tares. In Matthew 13, he in verse 24, he likened the kingdom kingdom of heaven is likened to a man that sows good seed in his field. While men slept, his enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat. And it sprung up, but the tares came up also. The servants of the householder came and said, "Sir, didn't you sow good seed in your field? Where did all these tares come from?" He said, "Well, an enemy has done it." And the servant said, "You want us to go try to pull them all out?" He said, "No, because while you're doing that, you'll root up some of the wheat with them. Let them grow together until the harvest, and in the time of the harvest, I'll tell the reapers to gather first the tares and bind them in bundles and burn them. Gather the wheat into my barn." Well, it comes on down, and Jesus explained this parable. See, they ask him in verse 36, "Declare to us the parable of the tares." And he said, "Well, he that sows the good seed is the Son of Man. The field is the world. The good seed are the children of the kingdom. The tares are the children of the wicked one. The enemy that sowed them is the devil. The harvest is the end of the world. The reapers are the angels." He says, this is the way it'll be. Son of Man will send forth his angels. Verse 41, "Shall gather out of his kingdom all things that offend and them which do iniquity. They'll be burned up. And the righteous will shine as the sun." So, what we find in this parable, interestingly, is that we see tares sown in among the wheat. You know, and that means that there are things, as we have seen even in our experience over the years, there are sometimes those who are in the church physically, but they're not in the church spiritually. You see, ultimately, the difference between the tare and the wheat is the tare never brings forth fruit. Oh, it may look sort of like wheat when it's coming up. That's the difficulty. But the issue is settled once the fruit has developed. Because ultimately, the wheat brings forth fruit and is of value to be harvested. The tares never bring forth fruit. Can you always tell the tares from the wheat? Well, not early on. In fact, sometimes it's a matter that things, you know, are simply allowed to grow together, and there are some things that only God can sort out. Some things become obvious, and, you know, there are other scriptures that show that there is a matter of church discipline. There are things that have to be dealt with. But sometimes it's a matter we can't figure everything out. If you try to root out every tear, you're going to undoubtedly rip up some wheat with it. And so, you know, we see that. Ultimately, the tares are representative of those things that offend and which do iniquity, which practice lawlessness. So, they're those, you know, over the years, who could not understand why certain problems maybe existed. I don't know about you. When I came into the church, I remember when I went out to Ambassador College, I knew I wasn't perfect, but I figured everybody else was. And, you know, I knew that everybody was doing everything. I mean, that's, it said, you know, we were supposed to do it, so surely they were. And I figured if I could get out there and sort of get around it, well, surely, you know, it'd sort of rub off on me, you know. And you begin to realize, well, it's not perfect. And sometimes you didn't realize how many problems there were because everything wasn't obvious. You're new, and you know it's. But yeah, God has allowed Satan sometimes to sow some tares in among the wheat, and every problem is not going to get solved in the here and now. I mean, we just have to recognize that. Christ said it. You read the New Testament, and you find out it was true in the first century. And my experience tells me it's been true in this century. I suspect most of you have come to realize that. So, you know, this, yes, certain problems and offenses will occur until Christ comes back and solves the whole problem. You know, as we come on down, that the account here of the parables, we're told that he didn't expound anything didn't teach the multitudes anything except that he used parables. Mark 4:34 and the parallel in Matthew says the same thing, that without a parable he didn't speak to them. And then when they were alone, he expounded all things to his disciples. So he sent away the multitude, and they were going to cross over the Sea of Galilee to the area of the Gadarenes. Now, let's go back here in... we'll come back here to Matthew 8 and... as we get the account and get some of the details, because Matthew chapter 8 tells the story. Here we'll pick it up, let's see, on down about verse 22. This is after he had come back across to Capernaum and was here. He sees the multitudes, and verse 19, a certain scribe came and said unto him, Master, I'll follow you wherever you go. And Christ said, the foxes have holes, the birds of the air have nests, the Son of Man doesn't have where to lay his head. Another disciple said, well, Lord, let me first go and bury my father, then I'll be able to come back and really follow. And Christ said, well, follow me, let the dead bury their dead. And when he was entered into the ship, his disciples followed, and there arose a great tempest. And it comes on down in verse 28, where he calmed the waters, and then in verse 28 he entered into the country of the Gergesenes or Gadarenes, just alternate spellings of the same thing. And we have the account of the individual being the Matthew records that there were actually two individuals, and the demons were cast out and went into the swine. So the account here in the latter part of Matthew 8 matches up this account with what we were seeing in Mark chapter 4 and 5. I want to comment on this matter of letting the dead bury the dead. You know, was Christ being callous and hard-hearted and saying, well, you know, don't go to your father's funeral? No. I mean, plenty of other scriptures certainly show that. The point Christ was making, in effect, what this fellow was saying was, look, once my father's dead and everything's been settled up, then I'll be able to come back and really concentrate on following you. You know, but I better go back and sort of see after things and, you know, take care of everything at home. And then once it's all over with, well, then I'll be your disciple. And Christ said, let the dead bury their dead. Let the spiritual dead, you know, those that are not being called, those that God is not working with right now. In effect, he was using the fact that he had an elderly father at home as an excuse to put off acting on the calling that Christ had given him. And so Christ was telling them, let the spiritual dead bury the dead. In other words, he had plenty of unconverted relatives who could fulfill the physical duties that he had, but not the spiritual duties that he had. So we have the account here where they crossed, they got on the boat, and Christ went to sleep. And the storm got worse and worse, and they were scared, and the storm must have been bad because these were experienced men of the water, you know, experienced sailors, and they said, Lord, save us, we're about to die. In verse 26 of Matthew 8, he said, why are you so fearful, you of little faith? He arose and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was great calm. The men marveled, saying, what manner of man is this, that even the winds and the sea obey? Can you imagine, you know, the shock effect. They had seen Jesus perform miracles. But, you know, he was somebody that they lived with day in and day out. And in the midst of a storm, to wake up somebody and to see them simply look out at the storm and say, "Peace, be still," and all of a sudden the wind stops and the water becomes like glass, you know, that would have to be just an overwhelming thing. It's like, what? You know, what manner of man is this? I mean, this is just, this goes so far beyond anything we could have even imagined happening. You know, the wind and the sea obey it. Well, you know, he's the one that spoke the words and commanded the sea to be gathered in one place. He's the one that said, "Let there be light." He's the one that initially commanded these things to come into action. Of course they obeyed him. You know, his voice was the one that called them into existence. They didn't understand that at that time. You know, that was something that sort of gradually dawned. But we have the account. You know, Matthew and Mark both give it. They Luke in chapter 8 gives parallel as well, as they entered here, and it tells about the arriving at the country of the Gadarenes. Luke 8:26 gives another parallel, and again the preceding account is of the storm being still. That's why I say, if you follow it through in Mark and Luke, then you look back to Matthew, you realize how Matthew sort of jumps around. But you can, using Mark and Luke as sort of your chronology, you can line up the parallel accounts from Matthew, and you often find Matthew gives more details, though he tended to jump around a little more. But the point of the thing was that they came and they met this individual or individuals with unclean spirits, and we find that Christ rebuked the demons. In this case, it was multiple demons. He said, "You know, my name is Legion," which referred to this, you know, great multitude. We are many, and that sometimes, you know, that's sometimes the case. I know of sometimes multiple demons that are involved. Sometimes just one. This individual had had many, and anyway, they. Christ allowed them to go into the herd of swine, and the swine, when the unclean spirits, as Mark brings out in Mark 5:13, when they went out and entered into the swine, the herd ran violently down a steep place into the sea. There were about 2,000, and they were choked in the sea. And of course, the people that were there watching the swine fled. It scared them to death. They ran into the city and told everybody they saw. And when people came out there, here was Legion, who had been known, you know, as this insane, violent individual. He was sitting there clothed in his right mind. He just, you know, seemed normal as anybody. And when they saw what had happened, they wanted him to leave. They wanted Jesus to leave. It just scared them to death, transpired, you know, the God's power. They were terrified. Matthew, Mark, and Luke all give the account. Down in verse 37 says that Luke 8 says the whole multitude of the country of the Gadarenes round about besought him to depart from them, for they were taken with great fear, and he went up into the ship and returned back again. And the man from whom he had cast out the demons wanted to go with him, but Jesus told him, "You know, you go back home and you show everyone the great things that God has done with you, has done for you." So then we come to the account Luke and Mark show of coming back here to the. They crossed over and came to the town, and this man, Jairus, who was a ruler of the synagogue. And that account again is given in those three different accounts of Jairus coming out, and this is the Jairus coming out and desiring that his daughter be healed. You can read in Matthew 9 as well as on down here in Mark chapter 5 and Luke chapter 8. And the daughter died before Christ got there, and of course Christ put all the other folks out, took Peter, James, and John with him and the parents, and went in there and told the little girl, raised her from the dead. That was a tremendous miracle as that occurred. Mark gives the account in Mark chapter 5, and Mark adds in a detail that when the ruler had come to him, that in the meantime there was a huge crowd of people. And in Mark 5:25, a certain woman that had an issue of blood 12 years. She had gone to every doctor she could find, and she had spent all her money, and she was no better off. She just, poor woman, there's no telling what all sort of remedies they put her through, but nothing solved her problem. And she had heard of Jesus and had heard about this, and so she came up there and just reached out to touch his garment. And she had in her mind, if I can just touch his clothes, I know I'll be healed. So she clearly had come to real faith and to really believe that he was not just some ordinary rabbi. She felt like, I don't need to do anything if I can just get close enough to touch his clothes. Well, immediately the blood dried up. She felt in her body that she was healed of the plague, Mark 5:29. Jesus, immediately knowing in himself that virtue was gone out of him, turned about and said, "Who touched me?" Well, the disciples said, "What do you mean, who touched you? You know, there's folks all around here. Well, no telling how many people touched you." But Jesus meant it in a special way. I mean, he knew it was not just somebody jostling up against him. And he looked around to see, and the woman, this frightened her. She thought maybe she was in trouble, and she came and fell down before him and told him everything. And he told her, verse 34 of Mark 5, "Daughter, your faith has made you whole. Go in peace. Be whole of your plague." And then Mark continues the account of Jairus' daughter and the little girl being raised from the dead. And she was... she was an outstanding example of faith, this particular woman, as we look at that, and we just, you realize here was somebody. There were all sorts of people that heard Jesus and saw him, but how many of them reacted in the way that this woman did? And she certainly is singled out here in terms of an example of faith. And so anyway, Mark 6:1 tells us that he went out from thence and came into his own country. And his disciples followed him. And when the Sabbath was come, he began to teach in the synagogues, and many hearing him were astonished, saying, "From whence has this man these things? Where did he get all this stuff?" Why, we know him, verse 3. "This is the carpenter. He's the son of Mary." This is clear indication, of course, that that Joseph was dead by this time, because Joseph's name isn't mentioned. But his mother was still alive. "He's the son of Mary, the brother of James and Joseph and Judah and Simon. Are not his sisters here with us?" So Mary was not a perpetual virgin, was she? Jesus had brothers and sisters. And they were offended at it. They said, "Where does this guy get off saying all this stuff? Why, that's the carpenter. That's the fellow that put an addition on my house. Where does he get off doing all this stuff? Well, I know him. He built that place over there across the road, and he did some work for me, and he remodeled over there, and we know all his family." they just really took offense that somebody that they knew, somebody that maybe they had hired a few years ago to do work on their house, that how in the world can he come around here and say all this stuff and do all these things? You know, somebody's going to be impressive. They have to be somebody you don't know and they've come from a long way away, right? If you know them. Well, he can't be important. I've known him for years. Anyway, Jesus said, a prophet is not without honor but in his own country and among his own house. Notice verses 5 and 6, Matthew 6. He could there do no mighty works except that he laid his hands on a few sick folk and healed them. And he marveled because of their unbelief. And he went round about the villages teaching. Now, even Jesus Christ could do no mighty works except there were a few individuals who were healed. Because, you know, back in the Psalms, I think it's Psalm 78, it talks about limiting the Holy One of Israel. How do you limit God? It talks about Israel of old, Israel in the wilderness, limiting the Holy One of Israel. How do you limit God? Well, we limit Him through unbelief. Yes, that is Psalm 78, Psalm 78, 41. They turned back, tempted God, and limited the Holy One of Israel. How did they limit Him? How did they limit Him? Through their unbelief. You know, they limited Jesus Christ right there in Nazareth. They limited Him through their unbelief. He marveled because of their unbelief. They just were so calloused and just tuned things out. As we come on down through the account, what we find next, you see, as you're going through Mark's account in Mark 6, is Mark 6, verse 7. He called his the twelve and sent them forth two by two. Well, let's go back in Matthew, you see, and we'll pick up the parallel account. The parallel account in Matthew 9 talks about the woman being healed of the disease. And Matthew 9:27 talks about the two blind men who were following him. And they came to him and they were following after him, actually, and saying, Son of David, have mercy on us. And he said, do you believe I'm able to do this? And they said, yes. He touched their eyes and he said, according to your faith, be it unto you. Their eyes were opened. So then we find someone who was possessed of a demon. The demon was cast out. The individual was able to speak. Christ here showed in the case of the healing of the blind man that, you know, faith is an important quality. He said, according to your faith, be it unto you. And that certainly was many times a factor. And you tie that in with where he could do no mighty works because of their unbelief. Well, the Pharisees went around and they were trying to put him down. Chapter 9, verse 34 of Matthew, they said, well, he's just casting out demons through the prince of the demons. Well, Jesus went around cities and villages, teaching in the synagogues, preaching the gospel of the kingdom, healing the sick. When he saw the multitudes, Matthew 9:36, he was moved with compassion on them. You know, that was Christ's attitude. He had compassion on the multitudes. He looked at these people, and he had compassion. They were scattered like sheep without a shepherd. And he said, verse 37, the harvest truly is plenteous, the laborers are few. Pray you, therefore, the Lord of the harvest, that he will send forth laborers into his harvest. You know, there's all of this to be done. Well, then, again, we come, Matthew 10 picks it up, where he called the 12, gave them power against unclean spirits to heal diseases, and he sent them out. And Matthew 10 verse 2 begins to name them. You know, the name of the 12 apostles are these. The first, Simon, who's called Peter, and then it goes on down. And I commented earlier, this term protos in the Greek, which basically it means first, and it could, depending on the context, refer to first in chronological order, or it could refer to first in importance. just like our word first could be. You know, it could have, depends on the context. Well, we know when you go back to John 1 and to the parallel accounts that Simon Peter was not the first chronologically to follow Jesus. In fact, his brother Andrew was a follower before Peter. Andrew went and got Peter and said, "Here, we found the Messiah. Let me come and introduce you to him." So Peter, in every one of the lists, is always listed first. Now, that didn't mean he was some infallible pope that towered way over everybody else. But on the other hand, you know, there was certain organization and structure, and Peter was the one that was used as the leader. And, you know, there's a balance on things. Seems like so often people want to go one extreme or the other. And they say, well, you know, shouldn't have any sort of government or leader. Well, I don't know of anything that functioned very well like that, you know, if you had more than one person involved. But, you know, there is a place somewhere between an infallible pope who speaks ex cathedra and something that's anarchy. God called these men, and Christ trained them and taught them, and yet there was a certain Peter was singled out as the leader. He's even denoted that way here in Matthew's account, leader of the 12. And of course, we find that normally even Peter, James, and John were often singled out as sort of an inner group. That was the way that God chose to work. Well, they were sent to go forth, Matthew 10 says, to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And he told them to go and preach and to heal the sick and to cast out demons. And he sent them out not with provision. He told them that as you come on through the story, you see, he says, when you, verse 11, into whatever town you enter, inquire who in it is worthy, there abide till you go thence. When you come into a house, salute it. If the house be worthy, let your peace come upon it. If not, let your peace return to you. And if you look again at the parallel, you know, the parallel accounts where he sent the 12 out. Luke 9 is a parallel where he sent the sent the 12 out, and Mark also provides that parallel. And the disciples, you know, when they returned back to him, you know, they were really amazed at all the things that that had happened. Well, Christ told them to go out. He told them, we were reading Matthew's account in Matthew 10. He said, "I'm sending you forth," in verse 16, "like sheep in the midst of wolves. Be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. Beware of men. They will deliver you up. They'll scourge you. But don't worry about it." You know, these things will, he said, it'll all work out. You're persecuted, verse 23, in one city, flee to the next. The disciple is not above his master. The servant is not above his Lord. So they were sent out to preach and to teach. Now, when he sent them around, initially, they were to go in and they would, you know, the accounts, they would preach and teach there. And then they would go on to the next place. You know, and what happened is they would come in and they would preach in like a public place, and there would be people that wanted them to come there to their home to explain more things. And, you know, Christ told them not to be just going from house to house making a pest out of themselves, but those who invited them come in and teach. And if if the people really were teachable and were worthy in that sense, not worthy in the sense that they were inherently so much better than anyone else, but they had they were worthy in their attitude. That's the way we're worthy. You know, none of us, it's not like, well, I'm worthy. I'm a lot better than he is, you know, so I'm worthy. You're not. The worthy part of it comes in if we have a humble, teachable attitude. You know, if you got that, it's amazing what you can learn and how things can fall into place. It's hard to teach somebody something who already knows everything. You ever notice that? So Christ said, you know, gave them those instructions. And the fact of the matter was that as they did those things, that people would give them things. They would, you know, their needs would be provided, and ultimately they were to learn freely they had received, and they were to freely give. They weren't to go around charging people for things and doing things like that. Jesus never did that, but on the other hand, you have the account of how he was, sent them out in that way. Now, as we continue on down, we've already seen the attitude that the people of Nazareth had toward Jesus, and he certainly didn't work many miracles there. That account, by the way, is we went through it in Mark, but you can also pick it up in Matthew chapter 13. All commission to the church was to go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. But the 12 were specifically commissioned to preach to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. You know, it's interesting. What's going to be their job in tomorrow's world? They're going to sit on 12 thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. They were sent to preach to those tribes. And I'm sure if we knew all the details of the history, we would know the extent to which different ones of the apostles primarily concentrated in their preaching to certain tribes. It may very well be that at least in most, if not all, cases, that will ultimately be the tribe that they actually rule over. You know, those were people that they were working with over a period of years. You know, that's not some great major doctrine, and I can't show you chapter and verse on it, but it can show you what their job's going to be and what they were sent to do, and it just sort of makes sense to me that the two probably have some sort of convergence. You know, Paul was sent in certain areas. You know, God, you have an overall commission, then it begins to break down into more specific things. And historically, of course, it's interesting to go through the areas as to where the 12 apostles did go. You know, they sort of drop out of the book of Acts after the Acts 15 conference. You really don't read about the 12. You read the details of where Paul went. There were things that God simply did not choose to have recorded because God did allow the 12 tribes to, or the 10 lost tribes to just be lost in terms of the understanding of most people. He allowed that to sort of drop from public view. And so there are certain details that are simply not recorded. We don't have chapters describing, you know, where Bartholomew was and where Thomas was and where, you know, Matthew was spending all this time, where Simon the Zealot went, and all of those details. There are certain things that have been preserved in history, and you can't always be 100% sure of every detail of it, but as you do put the story together, we find the two main areas were the area over in the east, where the 10 tribes were, portions of them were in the area of Parthia and east of the Euphrates, and then on up in northwestern Europe. Let's notice here in Christ's statement we had read earlier in Matthew, in Matthew chapter 10, where Christ told them to go out and to preach, And in the end of verse 8, see, he told them in verse Matthew 10:8, heal the sick, cleanse the lepers, raise the dead, cast out demons. Freely you've received, freely give. He told them in verse 10, the workman is worthy of his meat, worthy of his food. You know, you go out in faith and you trust that God will provide your needs. Freely you've received, freely give. Mr. Armstrong read those verses many decades ago in the very early part of his conversion, and when he launched the World Tomorrow program, Radio Church of God, as it was, as the radio program was there, he offered things for free. He didn't get on there and ask for money. He offered what he had for free, and he trusted that God would provide. You know, if you remember reading in the autobiography, he asked the members in the local congregation if they would pledge money toward the broadcast. And he came up, seems like to me, with about half of it. And so he just stepped out on faith. Well, you know, God will provide. And then he got on there and offered to give stuff away. It makes quite a contrast. You hear all these guys on there, you know, for $20 I'll send you this tape and all these things. Well, that's what Christ said. And, you know, it worked. It worked. The truth is too precious to put up for sale. You know, someone's lack of money is not the thing that ought to stand between them and understanding the truth of God. And it just, it illustrates a principle. Christ went on and he told them, you know, that there would be persecution, sometimes even government persecution. Here in Matthew 10:16-27, goes through all of this, and he says, you know, they're not going. Don't expect that they're going to treat you a whole lot better than they treated me. But what claim do you and I have to be treated so much better than Jesus was treated? Well, I certainly deserve better treatment than he got. Well, no, you know, he can't say that. So he says, you know, it's enough for the disciple to be as his master. So don't worry about it. If they've called me Beelzebub, verse 25, they've called the master of the house Beelzebub, how much more will they call his own household? So, you know, will we have our motives maligned? Will we have false accusations? Well, sure, that'll happen from time to time. Happened to Jesus. So, those kind of things. But he said, verse 26 of Matthew 10, fear them not, therefore. There's nothing covered that'll not be revealed and hidden that'll not be known. You know, don't worry about what people say and false accusations and all sorts of things. The truth eventually will always come to the top. Sooner or later, you know, it all gets out. What I tell you in darkness, speak in the light. What you hear in the ear, preach upon the housetops. You ever think about that? We do that in a literal way. Where does, you know, people's receivers for broadcasting? Well, you know, traditionally up on the housetop. That's not the primary meaning that he has, but it's sort of an interesting thing, you know, how that sort of worked out. Fear not them, verse 28, which are able to kill the body, but are not able to kill the soul. Rather, you better fear him who's able to destroy both soul and body in hell, in Gehenna. Soul is psuche. It's the word we get our word psyche from. It refers, the body, of course, is just that, soma. But the term soul, the Bible does not speak of an immortal soul. The soul is not inherently immortal. But the point that he's making is the worst that a man can do to you is kill you. But you know, he has not blotted out your existence forever. He's not blotted out your memory, your character, all the things that give you unique individuality. God retains that. And the time is going to come when he's going to raise, when you're resurrected. It's not just that the physical body is recreated, but the mind, the memory, the character, the personality, all of the things that are uniquely you, your psyche, that which is inherently you. You know, you can lose a hand or an arm or a leg. Some people have lost legs and arms, but you know, they're still themselves. I mean, in their mind, That's Christ said, look, you don't need to worry about what people can do. You know, think about God. Because ultimately our life is in His hands, and He's the one who can destroy both body and soul. Both, not only your body, but you. That which is uniquely, inherently you can be blotted out forever. Which, of course, does show that the soul can be destroyed. I mean, that's the Protestants who try to use this verse, you know. Some will try to use it. See, you've got an immortal soul. Well, it says the soul can be destroyed in Gehenna, so the soul doesn't burn forever in Gehenna. Soul is destroyed in Gehenna, right along with the body. Said, are not two sparrows sold for a farthing? One of them shall not fall to the ground without your Father. The very hairs of your head are numbered. Don't worry. You're of more value than many sparrows. You know, God keeps up with things. God is aware of every detail of His creation. God has a mind that's capable of processing far more than the largest supercomputer. You know, if you could link all the supercomputers together, it wouldn't be a fraction of the mind of God. You know, we read some of these things, and sometimes hard to realize how literally it can be true. I think with the advent of computers, we become more conscious of how much information can be stored and retrieved in a short time. You realize, you know, the mind of God goes so far beyond any of that. God didn't have to send somebody down to buy him a good computer because, you know, he couldn't keep up with everything, and he saw this thing that man had invented and thought he needed one. No. So Christ said, look, nothing's going to happen to you that God's not aware of. It's not like you're going to go out here and be preaching. Somebody's going to grab you and do something, and you think, man, I wish God had known about that. He might have done something. You know, a sparrow doesn't fall that God's unaware of. God can keep up with everything, and He certainly can keep up with you. And me. He's a lot more concerned about us than He is the sparrows. We're a lot more valued. So, if God knows everything else that's going on, if God is aware of something, not a sparrow falls that without God being able to be aware of that, He will keep up with us down to the most minute detail. It's sort of interesting the expression Christ used, the very hairs of your head are numbered. You know, that means not only is God keep up with something, but He has to keep up with it on an ongoing basis, because that's a number that's constantly changing. Now, He has less trouble with some of us than He does with others, doesn't He? Some of us take a lot, you know, less of His attention. He doesn't have to count as high. But anyway, there are several of us that fall into that category. But the point that He's making is, I'm sending you out to do something. Yes, you're going to encounter adversaries. You're going to encounter trouble and difficulty. Don't be intimidated by it. Don't worry about what people say, what people accuse you of, what people threaten you with. You concentrate on really walking with God, on really going forward, doing what God has, you know, sent you to do. You just concentrate on that, and it'll all fall into place. Everything will come together. And He says, if you confess me before men, I'll confess you before my Father. You deny me before men, I'll deny you before my Father. You know, we've got to be prepared to stand up for what is right, not to deny Jesus Christ. You know, we don't want Him to be ashamed of us, and we therefore better not be ashamed of Him. He says in verse 34, don't think I've come to send peace on earth. I didn't come to send peace, but a sword. I'm come to set a man at variance against his father and the daughter against her mother, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's foes will be those of his own household. He that loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. He that loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Now, Christ didn't mean that He just wanted to see people fight and have trouble. What He said was, look, if you follow me, you may run into conflict and difficulty even in your own family. You know, many of us had that experience years ago. I guess one of my... I've told the story several times because to this day, one of the most vivid memories of my life is the first Christmas I didn't keep. You know, We in many cases, saw families thrown into turmoil. We saw upset and problems. And some people had more trouble than others did. But it came down to the fact that when you start following Jesus Christ, you're not going to be in the mainstream of society. That's not what the rest of the world is doing. That doesn't mean you try to make conflict in your family, but it means that Christ has to come first. Well, you know, God won't take second place. That's not acceptable in His life. And, you know, oftentimes, I think in, you know, so many cases, as time goes by our example, we can certainly impact our families in a positive way, and they may get over some of the initial hurt and upset because they didn't understand, and things can be resolved. But what we have to come down to, none of us know, you know, what's happened. I've known people that have literally been thrown out because they were going to obey God. They were going to keep the Sabbath or some of these things and just, you know, get out. Well, we have to be prepared to accept the consequences, to realize that many times there are problems even in a family because some understand and others don't. But if we have to put Christ first, Matthew 10:38, "He that takes not his cross and follows after me is not worthy of me. He that finds his life shall lose it, and he that loses his life for my sake shall find it." So you see, if the primary thing we're after is protecting ourselves, then we're not going to be successful. We just have to follow. We have to take up whatever our responsibility is and follow. And instead of putting our primary focus on this physical life and all the things accompanied with that, that we're prepared to lose our life for His sake. In that sense, sacrifice ourself to follow Him, and that ultimately we'll have real life, eternal life. He goes on, "He that receives you receives me. He that receives me receives him that sent me. He that receives a prophet in the name of a prophet will receive a prophet's reward. He that receives a righteous man in the name of a righteous man will receive a righteous man's reward. And whoever shall give a drink to one of these little ones, a cup of water only in the name of a disciple, truly I say, he'll in no wise lose his reward." You know, we find that the way we treat Christ's representatives is certainly taken personally by Him. Now, let's go back here and mark once again. We saw in Mark 6:7, He called the 12 and sent them out 2 by 2. And so we're told that as He said in verse 12 of Mark 6, they went out and preached that men should repent. That's what they preached. They told people that they needed to turn their lives around. They cast out many demons, anointed with oil many that were sick, and healed them. Now Herod, King Herod, heard about it. And Herod was a superstitious sort. He heard about it, and he got all worried. He said, "John the Baptist has risen from the dead. You know, he's come back to haunt." Herod was, you know, Herod knew that he shouldn't have beheaded John the Baptist, and evidently that had sort of worked on him, and he'd been nervous about it. The account is told here as to what had happened, that John the Baptist had preached a sermon, and Herod had thrown him in jail. Because John had told Herod, "It's not lawful for you to have your brother's wife." You know, Herod and his brother's wife sort of moved in together, and that was immoral, and John the Baptist didn't pull any punches. And Herodias, his brother's wife that he was living with, was all upset, and she wanted John the Baptist killed. Herod, verse 20, feared John. He knew that he was just and holy, And he would listen to him. And, you know, he liked to hear some of what John had to say. He was impressed with John. He knew John was right. And so he at least had a certain respect. But Herod was a weak kind of a fellow who basically gave in to his own appetites and his own vanities and jealousies and lusts. And so he was having a big birthday party. And the daughter of Herodias came in and danced and pleased Herod. And the king said to the damsel, "Ask me whatever you want and I'll give it to you." This was not a little six-year-old that came in and did a tap dance. She probably was young. She may not have been more than even 12 or 13, 14, something. She was probably fairly young, but she was old enough that Herod and his lust got all stirred up, and he said, "You know, I'll give you anything you ask." This has been popularized as what was called Salome's Dance of the Seven Veils. And so evidently she got rid of some of the veils somewhere along the line. Just to show you how corrupt morally the whole family was, you know, Mrs. Herod knew what the results of this was going to be. And so, you know, here her daughter's going down here, and she'd already put her daughter up to it. You get him all stirred up, and then when he makes you an offer, you come check with me. So she came back and asked her mother, and her mother said, "You tell him that what you want is John the Baptist's head on a charger." And we're told the king was exceeding sorry. Mark 6:26. He was exceeding sorry, but he was embarrassed to back down now in front of everybody. So he sent an executioner and had John the Baptist beheaded. And they brought this grisly thing on a plate to the girl, and she carried it to her mother. And John's disciples came and took up his corpse and laid it in a tomb. Matthew gives in a couple of extra details. It tells about Matthew 14, starts out, you know, Herod the Tetrarch hearing of John, and gives the same account. And it goes on down basically through the, you know, through the same thing. So we come down to the you know, the end of this section, and what we will do as we come on to the next time, we will see that that the account brings us down to the time of the right before the Passover. That's where this ends up. You don't know that yet, but next time we'll see that there's an account that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, all four, give. And John makes it plain that it occurred right before the Passover. That was the feeding of the 5,000, which you come right on into that here, Mark 6:30 on down. So basically what we've done is come up this period of several months. It brings us up to where next time we'll be starting in on the last year of Christ's life. And what we'll find is that the further we go through, the more details that are given, the more, in effect, the account sort of slows down and focuses in on detail. So with that, we'll be concluded here this evening, and I've got study questions.